I'm going to be speaking with David Hewitt about On the Road, recording the stars in a golden era of live music. Here's a little something he did with these chaps called Pink Floyd.
Dream, hot air for a cool breeze, cold comfort for you.
from the delicate sound of thunder, Pink Floyd.
Oh, boy.
Pink Floyd, David Hewitt, on the road, recording the stars in a golden era, a story of a life spent on the road, recording a rich diversity of music in America and elsewhere, including that. Delighted to be joining me live on the line to reflect on a career that not only took in recording, but also took in another of my pet loves, motor racing as well. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the States, David Hewitt. David, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Oh, good morning. Yes, thank you for having me.
Good to have you with. Whereabouts in the States are you this morning?
In Pennsylvania, lovely Pennsylvania, out in the woods.
A nice part of the world as well. Tell me a little bit about how you got involved with recording live broadcast records, audio, because I believe it all came about because of a young lady. Is this true?
Oh, it's always about a young lady, isn't it? And my original career, as we started to talk about, was in sports cars, and I built them and did some racing and so on. But as you said, you know, there was a wonderful young lady who was a singer that I started to get involved in, and I played a little guitar, but I couldn't quite play well enough to make it in the band, but as I often joke, I learned how to punch the big red record button, and that led to a recording studios, and at one point I decided to jump ship and get into the studio business. And then from there, it kind of turned into the remote recording aspect of it, which better suited me, because I grew up I'm an Air Force brat. We lived all over the place, and including Europe. You know, we started to talk about the Nürburgring and that kind of thing. So I had a lot of experience with being on the road and big machines and that kind of thing. So that kind of turned into building remote recording studios.
And what was this? What was the sort of technology like? Because, you know, what was the equipment you were working with, you know, back in the day, as it were?
Well, when I joined it, it was still in, you know, relatively small gas-powered trucks, you know, with a relatively small box on them. And I kind of walked into that after quite a long run around the country trying to get work as a studio engineer. But as I walked back into the record plant studios in New York, at the time were the big do. New guys on the block, and as I walked in the door, in the front door, I walked into the guy that was running the little mobile recording studio there, and he basically grabbed me by the shirt and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Nothing. You're coming with me." And he drags me out to the little remote truck because he had nobody to go with him to do a series of remotes. You know, the studio had all kinds of studio engineers and so on, but they virtually had nobody that knew how to deal with the road, drive a truck, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, off we went in the dead of winter in the snowstorms by the lake to do record the Mahavishnu Orchestra, you know, which at the time was a very new, you know, high energy jazz fusion, and there was some local band opening for them called Aerosmith, and they were just as loud as Mahavishnu Orchestra. But you know, so we did that, and I thought, okay, now we're going home. No, we're going to Boston. And we drove up there and did the Boston Symphony. You know, all of a sudden it's, you know, we went from the, you know, from the rock to a full symphony orchestra for RCA Red Seal, and there's another long story there. And we get done with that, and I say, okay, now we're going back to New York. Yeah, but we're going down to do a recording at one of the clubs downtown, and yeah. It was there was a folk singer that was headlining the show, but there was some guy that was the sort of the opening act named Bruce, and that was Bruce Springsteen, and that was the you know, kind of his first. He'd already done an album, you know, but it wasn't out really, and he hadn't started that landslide yet. But that was the first one, and those two shows became the first episode of the King Biscuit Flower Hour. Now, you may not know that in Europe.
Yeah, the King Biscuit Flower Hour. I have, and I would remember that, to be honest with you, David. So what was the King... Oh. It sounds brilliant. What was the King Biscuit Flower Hour?
It was, and it turned into a monster of a client for us because it was all recording live music, you know, mostly rock and roll. And that went on for many, many years. King Biscuit was an old... product from the Deep South that had blues connotations to it, so that you know that name was worked real well for them, and they stayed in business for many years. We did hundreds of remotes with them, great client, and so off we went. And I never looked back. I never went back in the studio, really. You know, I became a specialist in that live recording.
And is that perhaps the more challenging thing? Because obviously, if you're in a studio, the artists come to you and you can have as many takes as you like. But when you're doing any sort of, be it Aerosmith, be it, you know, the Met Orchestra, it's live. So you can't say, okay, I'm sorry, I didn't press the right thing. And that shows how technical I am. Could you please go back and do that again? It must be, you know, the adrenaline must really be pumping.
Oh, absolutely, and that, you know, it's very much like racing in that sense, because you travel a long distance to a new place, you try and set everything up, and you fix all the broken stuff, and then the flag drops, and you're off you go, you know, you're running the race, and you finish, you pack everything up, and you leave. And I thought, well, you know, I kind of like that. I'm used to it. And there was the one that kind of ties that in for you. You would know about Watkins Glen.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. On the East Coast, yeah.
Yeah, and I had been there many times. In fact, I worked briefly for Roger Penske.
Of course, yes. Famous name, Rand Penske.
Back when he only had one Chevy agency to his name, and he was starting with the first Lola T70.
Ooh.
This is Can-Am Racing.
Yeah.
And they're back up at Watkins Glen, and I managed to get... I was working as a cheap line mechanic at his agency, you know, trying to get my start. And I kind of snuck on to the pit crew for that one. And, you know, they start that big Can-Am race with that Lola T70. And unfortunately, they had a bad crash. It was not their fault. But away that went. And I went off and long story short, I jumped ship and started getting into the music business. But then some years later, I come back to Watkins Glen, one of the early remote gigs, and... It was that big Watkins Glen concert where 600,000 people showed up for the Allman Brothers and the Grateful Dead and the band. It was a huge, huge, post
Woodstock sort of concert sort of thing.
Exactly.
And did you?
It was huge, huge show.
But I suppose having
I kind of came full circle.
And I suppose having sort of been, you know, in the pit crew mechanic on a T70, was that an open top T70 or was it closed cockpit? By the
yes,
way,
yes, yeah, it was. It was one of the first ones.
Yeah,
but they had put they'd stuffed a 427 into that. And that didn't quite work out too well. They went back to the smaller blocks. But, of course, Penske went on to rule the world.
Yes.
And still does. But I went off in another direction. I pitted for an English guy with a Lotus 23B, which was a lot of fun.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I the music and the beautiful singer kind of took over, and I ended up taking a left turn into the music
business. And this is presumably sort of late 60s, because you mentioned the T70s, that's late 60s, into the early 70s, and it's a really sort of interesting period of time for music, because obviously you're getting the bands are starting to play, you know, bigger festivals, you know, you've got stadium rock appears. You mentioned Aerosmith, who become sort of the masters of stadium rock, and people want to listen to live music on vinyl.
Yes, indeed. And you mentioned that. I was going to mention, too, the the growth of those huge shows. And in 1974, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and then Young did a huge stadium tour in America that kind of opened the door for that kind of monster tour. That was really the biggest, the start of those big, big, big money tours. And so we recorded some of that, in fact, some of the pictures on the front of my book, if you've seen that, are that band. That's Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, down on the bottom and then up on the top of it. And there's a great one of those shots that's actually in the photo section of the book has got this great picture of Neil. They finished whatever the show or the encore, and it's Neil walking off. And the shot is from stage left, mm-hmm. and he's got that Neil Young look of I showed them. I just did this, whatever kind of a solo, and he's still one of my remaining heroes. I ended up doing a lot of work with Neil Young over the years.
When you're recording something like this, are you sitting in the truck? Are you on the production desk? I mean, where are you? Stage left, stage right. Where would you put yourself to work on these things in the early days?
Well, you've got to start somewhere, yeah. And as I said there, I ended up driving the bloody truck, and then I knew how to run the MM-1000s, those big old mastodons that they used to record on. I did work in a studio before that, so then I became the tape op, and then I slowly managed to get into the seat, and start, because I'd already engineered. I'd worked at Regent Sound in Philadelphia. It's that bootstrap kind of thing. Back in those days, there were no schools, and you did it by jumping in and learning from the masters. So of course I had that advantage, because every one of these gigs, it's not like sitting in the studio doing an album. Every gig was different, and when you got a big act like that, there would be a star engineer that would come in. So I was able to learn an awful lot. And every gig,
was it quite interesting? Because I imagine the crowds at some of these festivals, especially 600,000 at Watkins Glen, could be quite raucous. And I believe that you're not a big fan of crowds either.
That's true. I'm not not real keen on that sort of thing. But you learn that. You learn that in the military. You learn that in racing. My dad was a career pilot. I learned how to fly. You get used to all of that sort of thing. So you just grin and bear it. But I did spend most of my time in the remote truck, doing the mixing and doing all that sort of thing.
Of course, it's not just the doing mixing and recording albums. I mean, there are some pretty impressive events that you've done as well. The Academy Awards, Live Aid, that must have been an interesting day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in that particular one, I was in charge of bringing all the remote trucks and all the rental gear and all that kind of stuff in. So I may have sat at the console for a couple of minutes, but mainly I'm running around supervising all that kind of stuff. There's an interesting story as well that's not technical, but that was ABC Television was
this, this would be the Philadelphia end, presumably, not the Wembley end. Yeah,
yes,
yeah, of course.
Yeah, yes, it was, and so to them, it's all just a TV show. And in one of the production meetings in the beginning of that thing, they decided we're not going to record any multi-track, and I'm going, what? No, we don't have time for that. It's too expensive. Nobody cares. Don't do that. And I'm going, but, and they said, no, that's it. We're TV. You guys are just audio. And so they did it, and we did not record any multi-track tape for that. Now, they did in London, of course, they did. And, yeah. And you can now find remixed albums of that. But for the show in Philadelphia, there's no multi-track, so you've got live mixes from the from the consoles. And for years after that, I would get a call from some producer of one of the acts that had played that and saying, well, where's the multi-track tapes? And I said, well, here's the phone number for ABC Television.
Good grief.
And there's none of it.
So, I mean, at the end of a day like that, did you just sort of sink back into your armchair and sort of pull yourself a long one? And well, you know, no, was there any was there an after party for the crew, or you know, how did that one end?
Oh, everybody was so exhausted. You know, that was like a week of nonstop stuff, and the show itself was I don't know, 14, 15 hours. You know, and we were all going around the clock. So we just went back to the hotel and dropped dead. You know?
I mean, the way that the business has changed, the technology has changed. I mean, from, you know, mid to late 60s to, as I said, you did Delicate Sound of Thunder, which is, was that 87, 88, around that time? And now, of course, most people could record it on their laptops. It must make you sort of scratch your head and think how far it's all come.
It certainly has, and there was a point at which that I basically just walked away, because my life has been just like the title of that book, Recording the Stars in a Golden Era of Live Music. And I always thought about life in eras, and as that started to fade, I had sold my company anyway. I'd sold the remote trucks and so on, and as that whole business was starting to fade into recording on your phone, I basically walked away. In fact, I kind of back into some of the classic car restoration business, which you would love, off subject.
But, well, no, if you're going to spend your time doing something else, I think, you know, pottering around with classic cars is probably, you know, the thing that you want to do.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, and some of that went. I was going to mention one other thing that you might have been interested in. You know, in 1979, there was a huge effort made to do the Havana Jam. I don't know if you'd ever even heard of that. It was not a big item when it finally got done. But it was, you know, it was kind of a crack in the Cold War door, you know, to try and open up Cuba, you know, which was completely isolated and nuclear missile, all that kind of crazy shit. But it was primarily driven by Billy Joel, and the reason for a lot of that is that, you know, his parents were a Jewish family that fled Nazi Germany, and it took them 3 or 4 years to get a visa for the States, but they made it to Cuba, and okay. So they stayed there, and Billy Joel's father lived in Cuba. So all these years later, you know, when they come to New York and they go through all the, and everybody knows, you know, what Billy Joel became.
Yeah.
Well, he was kind of instrumental in putting together the Savannah Jam, which was going to be a big, big, you know, multi American bands and Cuban bands and all this great stuff. And it was a huge, huge success there, even though for Columbia Records, who put up all the money, you know, to do this, and it was a huge, huge expense.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nothing, you had to charter planes from South America. You couldn't fly there from America. You know, it was all still locked down from that end. But it was a huge, huge show, great, great stuff. But Billy Joel or his wife at that time, there's a confusion about that. When they found out that Columbia was going to do this as a record and a profit-making thing, he didn't like that. He thought that the whole thing was going to be, all the money was going to go to the Cuban kids and
yeah.
schools and, you know, all the good stuff, ignoring the fact that Columbia Records is spending a bloody fortune, you know, to do this, you know, and I built a huge system to bring down there to record it. But they said no. And so Billy's the headliner. You know, they go through all three or four days of all the great Cuban bands, and oh my God, all this, you know, the Mahavishnu Orchestra was down there, you know, all these big, big bands, and Crosby, Stills, well, not the whole band, but Steve Stills was in down there, all kinds of, you know, big acts. Billy's the headliner. They get down to the end, a huge, huge success, you know, the crowd's going nuts and all that. But there's these two guys out in my, you know, I built a portable studio, and they made me take the tape off of the machines.
Good grief.
So and I keep telling them, look, you can always lock the tape up, but if you don't record it, it's gone. You know, it's there. So once again, you know, all those years later, that was one of Billy's greatest performances. because it's you know, Cuba meant so much to him.
Yeah.
And, you know, because of his father.
And also, that's Cuban music, literally sort of, 20 years before, 15 years before Ray Cuda does the Buena Vista Social Club and discovers all that music.
Absolutely, yeah. It was just such a phenomenal experience. And a bunch of other
stuff. So why the book now? When normally I used to ask that question before, people would say I had a little time on my hands, but obviously what we've all been through recently, was this the right time to put it all in on the road?
Well, I'll tell you the truth, I started doing that. Like I say, I walked away from the business, just closed the door and went on with my the next era of my life. But I wanted to document what I had done, what my family business had been for my kids. I've got three children who are adults now, including Ryan Hewitt. My oldest son is a very successful engineer producer. But, it started out doing that. And we had, in the States and probably in Europe, commercial trucks have got to document every movement. And fortunately, we had pretty good truck logs from the black truck on, and I had my own logs. So, I sat about in my leisure of writing all, the whole list of all these gigs that we had done all over the country, in Europe and South America, all over the place. I found to my amazement that I had recorded well over 2,000 shows.
Wow.
With this. And as you know, if you document something like that, it can often jog the memory that may be hard to access otherwise. If I look on the, on that sheet of all those, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shows, and I see, let's say Ry Cooter on there, and I go, and then it jogs the memory, because you've got a solid fact to look at. So I wrote, I started out writing it for the kids, but as I realized, what a huge number of shows there were, and like you say, the evolution of that music, and at one point when I did finally get a book deal, they were they early on they asked me, well, what's the title? And I went, title, oh shit, okay, On the Road, Recording the Stars at a Golden Era Live, and I'll fix that later. Well, they didn't give me that opportunity, and they're, they have publishers having a department that does these, if you look at that cover, they did that. Their department did it, and I thought they did, because I submitted the photographs, and I went, I guess I'm stuck with the title, and that doesn't look so bad after all. Look at the, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. That's Bruce Springsteen in the middle. That's from a show where he did the first of his Christmas songs, which became famous, speaking of Christmas.
Yeah.
And the only thing is they'd taken a photograph of a different engineer. And I said, excuse me, I'd like to be on there instead.
And you've also got some tales of, obviously, because you recorded Muddy Waters with the Rolling Stones, and I believe that Les Paul was, the guitar Les Paul, the very same, was quite a party animal. I believe that you left the party as he was coming in.
It's true. He's such an amazing character. I've had a number of things with him, including recording. We went out and recorded. What was it? His 150th birthday, I think it was. he never stopped, and it was. I'm sure you know who Eddie Kramer is.
Yeah.
The engineer that did all the Hendrix albums and everything. So became a good friend and another race car guy. And he was going to record it, so he hired our big silver remote truck, and we went down and recorded his birthday. And when we finished wrapping the truck and all the other stuff, and I don't know, it's 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and I go into, you always do a last walk through in the theater to see if you left anything.
Sure.
And he's up there, almost everybody else is gone, and he's up there with three young women making them laugh and carry on. And he's a night owl. He still is.
And so Oh, I mean, you say, you know, tinkering around in the studio. Now you're tinkering around in cars. What are you working on at the moment with your classics? And what have you got planned for next year?
Well, as little as possible. I live out in the country in a wonderful old stone farmhouse that was built in the early 1800s. It turns into a long story. The whole farm and estate and everything was owned by the Leyden family, and that's where Leyden Restorations was founded. And if you look that one up, because you'll love it. You know, they became one of the best classic car restoration companies. Very, very, very serious small operation. But the whole thing was sold to a wealthy car collector because he wanted to keep it going.
Yeah.
And so they expanded it and added a lot of stuff. But at any given moment, there's just incredible cars in there. And I helped them get it organized. When I left the business, and because I had a knowledge of the cars and the rest of the stuff, I helped them reorganize it. And I don't really work in it anymore, but they're real friends, and I still go over there to see what's in there. For instance, there's a 1956 Ferrari. Is it a Monza? I think it is. It was one of the big 3-liter four cylinder multicams, a very very innovative engine, and it's all original, and there's.
I would be afraid something. To touch it in case I dented it and cost, you know, knocked another million off the price.
Oh yeah, it's very, very much like that, and just endless cars going through there. So I just love that.
Yeah.
And of course, I can't afford them.
But hey, but it's always good to look. The book is called On the Road, Recording the Stars in a Golden Era of Live Music. It's by David Hewitt, who we'll be speaking to today. I believe there's a website. Is it DavidHewittOnTheRoad.com if people want to find out some more information?
That's the one. Yes, thank you for that. And they can find out how to order the book. It's now in its second printing.
And it will be available as a virtual download from our virtual bookstore. I've got to cut it because I'm going to crash the news, as the saying goes, David, but it's been lovely to speak to you. And yes, a shared love of cars. This book is called On the Road, Recording the Stars in a Golden Era of Live Music. It's by David Hewitt. David, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you, and happy motoring to you.
Absolutely.